Welcome back to the Broken Middle Podcast. I'm your host, Pastor Kurt Poland. This is a podcast where people trying to make a difference in the world of faith, art, or politics make a good faith effort to understand each other. Today's guest is the Reverend Kirkpatrick Tyler, an African Methodist Episcopal preacher and the director of Skid Row Outreach for Mayor Garcetti's office. Over the course of the conversation, Kirkpatrick helped me see the Skid Row community in an entirely different light. He helped me realize that the first question is not, how do we lift people out of Skid Row, but rather, who lives on Skid Row, and what kind of a community is it? I also got a much better sense of what it's like to be a working pastor who also works for the office of an elected official. I hope that this podcast proves as transformative for you as it was for me. Reverend Kirkpatrick Tyler, welcome to the Broken Middle Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start out by talking a little bit about how you, an African Methodist Episcopal preacher, came to work for the mayor's office.
It wasn't an opportunity I was going to take because I've never worked for an elected office. A lot of my background had been in activism and advocacy. I've been in community. And so the idea of working for an elected seemed like a really tight line to have to walk. And I think maybe like my first month in, I ended up in the middle of a protest line, right? Where it was like PD on one side, the people that I usually would be out marching with on the other, and trying to like figure out, whoa, what do you do here? I had started my own company in 2014, working with faith-based organizations to help them build out their benevolent ministries to connect directly to our homeless service system. Was doing some work with a couple of congregations, really like helping them build those networks, helping them to do, I guess what now has been termed as discernment. Right. So the discernment process, helping congregations look at what populations they wanted to serve, what resources they had, and really was just there. And a mentor of mine reached out and said, hey, there's an opportunity in the mayor's office. And I want to see if you would be interested in taking a look. And at first I was like, no, I'm cool. I was doing something that I love because I was working for myself. I didn't have to be fettered to anything. And, I was making enough money to be okay. So it's kind of like, I don't know if I want to take that risk. And in her wisdom, she says, I think you need to at least get the information and take it into consideration. And so I did. I went and did the first interview. And honestly, what pulled my attention was that there were so many people who worked in this office that were activists that came from that side of the work into this office. And that said, like, oh, there must be something to this guy that he would engage so many people and entrust so many people with his administration who come from the side that is used to being in opposition. And I mean, like, a wide range of folks from union organizers to, people who had done some significant work in police reform to folks on the street. And I showed up like as my full self. I think I had like my hair, like,
yeah, all the way
out, a bow tie, a jacket with like kente cloth. Like, I want you to, if you hire me, I want you to know who you're getting.
I love it.
So that when those things happen, that you're not surprised. And so,
I think the most important question though, in self-representation is, did the kente cloth bow tie match the pocket square?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. It was actually, my wife made the jacket for me. So that was fun.
She made it for you.
Oh yeah. So, I mean, the jacket was already made, but she put the
okay,
that matched the bow tie. Yeah. Good question, man. You're good at this interview stuff. So I started out in this office and I served 2.5 years as the mayor's South Los Angeles field deputy, which was a wonderful opportunity. It's a neighborhood I grew up in. it kind of was like a perfect fit when I started doing the work.
Yeah, South LA, which neighborhood?
I grew up on 87th and Budlong.
Okay.
Yeah, so right off of Vermont and Manchester, right in that area. Lived on the same street in two different homes. So from like from 9 to 16, lived in one house, and then from 16 to 18, lived in another house directly across the street.
Wow.
That's actually the house that my father grew up in when he was a kid living in LA.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've been here for, your family's been here for a while.
Yeah. My grandparents moved here in the 50s from Mississippi. And so my dad and all of his siblings all grew up here. And,
wow.
And my grandmother is an AME bishop. But, and you know, we have itinerancy system.
Of course, so do we.
Yeah, right. And so she came here when I was 8 years old from Bakersfield.
Wow.
And so because our family was tight-knit like that, when she moved, we moved here. My father was already here. And so that the rest is history. And then I took an adventure at 18 to Atlanta. But
hold on. Because I lived in Atlanta for 4 years. Where'd you live in Atlanta?
So I lived in my final place. I was on Metropolitan Parkway, right before you get to Peter Street. So near like the AU Center.
The AU Center.
University Center, where all the black colleges are. And the
So like, that's like Clark Atlanta and Spelman Morehouse. Did you ever attend Central United Methodist Church for any reason?
Yeah. So I graduate. I'm an alumni of Morris Brown College.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. So we ended up going there often just because it was proximity. And one of our fraternity brothers like had a relationship there and everything. So yeah.
Who was the pastor there when you went there? Do you remember?
Oh no, I would probably murder whose name that was.
Okay. So I served that church for about 2 years when I was in seminary.
Okay. Oh wow.
And at that time I went to seminary at Candler. But I had lots of friends from ITC and
when were you at Candler?
Say what?
When were you at Candler?
So I was there from would have been 2008 to 2012 with my third year I spent in Germany. So okay. That's kind of a gap year. But I was at Central UMC as a ministerial intern from 2009 to 2010. Yeah. And then I came back again. And I wasn't officially an intern at that point, but I served the church and you know I would help lead worship occasionally on Sunday.
We just missed each other.
That's crazy. When were you there?
I was there from 99 till 2009 or 2010 when I left for grad school.
Wow.
Yeah. So that, wow. Our world keeps getting smaller and smaller, right?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah.
So,
okay.
So I served for 2.5 years as a South LA field deputy. And I guess probably really key to this conversation is the mayor decided to establish a homelessness team. So dealt with housing, dealt with interim housing, dealt with street strategy, and then something that had not ever been done before, appointed a director for Skid Row strategy specifically. So in the history of the city, there's not ever been a person specifically tapped to deal with Skid Row as its own community. And so that was January 2019.
So the mayor's office specifically created a job for Skid Row strategy in the. So okay, so then I mean that's really interesting. So in other words, I mean it seems like, administratively at least, the mayor takes the problem pretty seriously to create a position.
Yeah. So homelessness is actually an issue that is near and dear to his heart, and it's something he's super thoughtful about. So in creating an actual homeless team, Office of City Homeless Initiatives, and then, yeah, having the insight to say, we got to have a person dedicated to the work of Skid Row, was a game changer, you know? And that's not to this, I think it's brilliant, but I think like it speaks to the culture of the city, right? It's awesome that he did it, but culturally the fact that I'm the first ever means that we had not seen Skid Row as a community worthy of a person who should be engaging them, right?
Okay.
It kind of gets shuffled into the downtown work.
Right.
Part of why it has become that, because we end up spending a lot of time just moving people on the street around so that we could do the business of downtown, versus how do we service this community that is also in downtown Los Angeles, and begin to apply the resources, the funding, the representation that we have in every other community, because Skid Row is a community. It has very specific needs. It has its own set of politics. It has its own culture. It has its own stakeholders. And really, it's probably an intersection of everything in Los Angeles.
So this is really interesting. This is the very first time I've heard somebody talk about Skid Row, the Skid Row community. And it makes total sense to talk about it like that, because they know each other. I used to serve at an outreach center in downtown Atlanta. And one of the things that really blew my mind as a kid from the suburbs is that, yeah, there are heroes in the community. There are notorious people who kind of drop in and drop out, and word spreads when they come back into town, that sort of thing. So, to start opening this question up and changing how we think about the Skid Row community, what's one of the biggest misconceptions you think a lot of people in LA have about Skid Row right now?
Oh, just that it's not a community, that it's a place in downtown where homeless people are.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing to acknowledge is that there's a bunch of people that live in Skid Row that aren't homeless. There's a bunch of people that live in Skid Row that have lived in Skid Row and dedicated their life to servicing to being of service in Skid Row for, 20, 30 years. I had the opportunity to learn from and to engage with Brother Eddie H, who left us recently. But brilliant people who dedicated their life to uplifting and building up Skid Row. You talk about the Skid Row Brigade, you talk about General Jeff, you talk about General Doggone, you talk about OG, you talk about Deacon, you talk about Yusef, and you have all of these individuals and organizations. It's own community. You have our mission partners, Union Rescue Mission and Midnight Mission and LA Mission. You have our service providers like Homeless Healthcare. You have Downtown Women's Center. You have advocates, just all these awesome people, right? Suzette Shaw, who is a phenomenal advocate for women experiencing homelessness in Skid Row, and is relentless and does not allow anybody to talk about or look at Skid Row in a demeaning way, right? You've got people that have businesses, and whether, do they match up to what we think is appropriate or not, I don't think it matters. I think first we have to see Skid Row. And so I think the first misconception is that it's just a place where homeless people are.
Hmm.
Or it's a place where we could go and pass out water, or a place where we can go and, pray for people who must need Jesus because they're in this situation. Mm-hmm. So they can't possibly know God, right? And then you get there and find out maybe they could minister to you better than you could to them. And that's not to romanticize it and mm-hmm. overlook the real challenges and real needs that there are. But I think most people go into Skid Row backwards. We go in looking at the blight versus going in to look at the life. And when you go in to look at the life, it gives you a clear perspective on how to engage to address the blight. Urban Voices, which is a phenomenal choir made up of both people formerly experiencing homelessness and people currently experiencing homelessness. LA Poverty Department that engages in arts and culture for Skid Row residents, which there's a bustling arts community in Skid Row, right? Of residents of Skid Row who are awesome artists. And so the blessing for me has been one to be able to see that and experience it at a very intimate level. The first 3 months in this position, I just went and like sat with people and talked to them and heard from them and just got, you know, a more intimate relationship with Skid Row. And that made it easy to advocate for the resources that were available. It made it easy to fight for the stuff, you know, internally that was needed out in the street. So I think that's the biggest misconception.
I want to get that messaging as far as I can. Because I think you're totally right. I think oftentimes when I hear Skid Row mentioned in public rhetoric, it's frequently derogatory and kind of like a cautionary tale.
Right.
But exactly like you're saying, there it's a whole community, it's a whole culture, it's a whole world that in which there's a real sense of belonging and a sense of identity and a sense of expression and fullness. So here's, I guess my next question then would be this. One of the challenges that I remember facing when I was more regularly involved in homeless ministry was the sense that as I was trying to help people back into the system, you know, getting state ID, getting food stamps, getting access to affordable housing, I sometimes felt like doing these things was going to remove people from that community that they'd built up. And that after a certain number of years on the street, it really becomes, to transition later in life, you know, when you've been homeless for a while, becomes so disruptive to your sense of who you are, your community, the rhythms and the beats of your life, that it becomes increasingly unthinkable or undoable. And so I guess this is a question, because I can talk about this as a pastor, a spiritual question is like, are there scenarios like that on Skid Row today where you think that trying to transition somebody out or off the street might actually be worse for them than having them stay and kind of according to the rhythms, or am I missing something? I mean,
If I could approach it from a policy perspective, and then I'll go into pastoral.
Would love that. Yeah.
I think there's like a really poignant policy issue here. When we think of housing people experiencing homelessness, we do just that. We uproot them from a place where they have safety, community, and then we place them somewhere that is comfortable for us,
mm-hmm.
right? And when we are doing our city planning, when we are doing housing development, it is absent of the consideration that while this community might not be housed, it is indeed a community. And so one of the things that we pushed for this year were that when the 2040 plan, which is kind of the city plan that rolls out every 20 years about how planning guidelines and planning law and building planning, it basically sets the landscape for what the city will look like. Traditionally, Skid Row has just kind of been folded into downtown. Mm-hmm. This year, we actually pushed for Skid Row to have its own plan, that certain zoning and certain allocations and certain requirements were made to include the needs of the Skid Row community. And so there was a report that Sisters and Brothers in the Community, My Skid Row, they created a report that talked about what type of zoning and what types of housing needed to be preserved. And so we were able to take that information, and for as much as, you know, being in a political office allowed it to be definitely not perfect, but I think closer than we've probably ever been, to incorporate what types of housing needs to be preserved, what types of housing needs to be provided, what areas does there not need to be market rate, but only deeply affordable and affordable housing, because there's a difference between scooping a bunch of folks off the street and throwing them somewhere so we can do what we want to do here, right, and developing this community inclusive of the people that are currently here, right? And so, from a policy perspective, yes, absolutely, and it's in part why so many people opt to stay in the encampments or stay in the communities that they're living in while experiencing homelessness, because going into housing means being snatched away from the place that you figured out how to be safe, yep. right? And that's not for everybody, but that's a major thing. From a pastoral perspective, from a ministry perspective, we come from a faith tradition that is all about community, right? The gospel is spread. That's why we have Romans and Corinthians and Galatians, and because the gospel did not seek to pull people out of their community so they could go be Christians. It empowered them to practice the Christian life inside of the community that they were. And so while it was not the building of a physical home, it was the building of a spiritual home right in the place where people were. And I think there's not, as believers, there's not anything more Christian than we can do than to help people to feel, to become housed both physically and spiritually in the place that they're at. Right.
Amen.
I think we should take a lesson from that. Right. And that's actually the thing that Paul begins preaching against, like, no, you don't have to do all this crazy stuff. You don't have to go live here. You don't have to be circumcised. Actually, you just need to believe and practice that here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think we do a lot of damage in trying to move people. And that is more about what we desire than it is what is best for the people who we are attempting to displace, which is really what it is.
So talking about displacing and community and identity and place and living the Christian life inside the community you're already a part of, how transient is the Skid Row community? Do people come in and leave all the time? Are the people who've been there for years and years and years?
What's
the nature of the continuity there? What kind of community is it?
I think it you have both.
Okay.
You have people that have been there, like I said, for decades. And then you do have folks who live there at a time and maybe chose to move and took an opportunity that allowed them to move, but they still come back and they're still active. You know, again, like, it's a family. It's like if you move from state, but for Thanksgiving, you still come back home. On vacation, you still come back home. You won't find a bunch of people in Skid Row who do not have a connection to Skid Row. It's actually one of the conversations we're having now in like our housing policy is, as we are looking at available housing in Skid Row, we really should be focusing on getting people that live there into those units, because trying to either get people who live in Skid Row to move somewhere else is not going to be as successful, or trying to get people who are experiencing homelessness in another neighborhood to move to Skid Row is not going to be successful, as successful, or doesn't have as high a potential to be successful, because anything is possible. Either of those have a higher rate of success if you are preserving this community. And again, it goes back to this idea that Skid Row is a community.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't treat any other community as optional. Like, there's not a person, like, I grew up in South LA. I take that with me everywhere I go. You know, like, no matter what neighborhood I live in, I'm always going to be KP from South LA. And I think the same thing is true for sisters and brothers that live in Skid Row.
So, I mean, this way you talk about the Skid Row community and this vision you have for trying to house the members of this community where they are to preserve the continuity, it makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. Mm-hmm. What are the decisive actionable steps toward building this up, making this more of a reality? And then what are the main oppositions toward this vision that you're just so convincingly laying out?
Yeah, I think, and I want to say, like, this is the people's vision. You know, this is
okay. Got it. Yeah, yeah.
That I was able to learn by engaging the people. This is the language that they taught, you know, and I believe, like, you got to speak people's language if you're ever going to speak to them or represent them, right? And for whatever that means in this building, I'm the representative for Skid Row. I think actionable items are, in some ways, the things that we've tried to do, set just the standard, meet the standard needs, right? Again, we can't ignore that there are some critical needs in Skid Row around access to drinking water, access to showers and restrooms, access to adequate hygiene facilities, access to safe streets, right? So we have to set those things in place because we can't do anything. Everything else falls to the wayside if people can't just get their basic needs met because everything else takes time. Right. We could talk about development. We could talk about planning. We could talk about building housing. But by the time we build the housing, if everybody, you know, is suffering or dead or extremely ill, what good is it? So you have to kind of set the basic needs. And that's a lot of what advocates fight for. Like we want the basic needs immediately. Mm-hmm. The second part is engaging the community. And that's probably first. Again, I think so much has been lost because we spent so much time talking at Skid Row and not to Skid Row and doing things for Skid Row and not with Skid Row. However, whatever order you want to put those in. The third thing is that there does have to be a comprehensive strategy that takes into account all of the pieces. And I think that's another thing that we lost in Skid Row is that we have a number of different pieces to this work. And no individual piece is going to get it done. But if ever we were blessed enough to like weave it all together, Skid Row would be this phenomenally whole and healing community, which is what everybody's hopes for. Then you have to do tangible things like you have to change housing policy. You have to ensure that housing is affordable based on the needs of that community. The word affordable now gets kind of thrown around, you know, in a community where the average rental cost is $5,000, $3,000 is affordable. So it has to, you know, it has to be connected to what the reality is in that community, you know, or the median income, right? So you have to create affordable housing. You have to create businesses and employment opportunities. Really, again, you got to look at it like a community. Everybody drives down the street and you say, oh, live, work, play neighborhood, because everybody understands the benefit of a community where I can live there, I can work there, I can have leisure there. So mm-hmm. why wouldn't we create that in Skid Row? Why wouldn't we create a place where people can live, work, and play and have leisure? So there has to be entrepreneurship. There has to be business development. There has to be training and education. Then there has to be centers of engagement, right? We have to have places for people to gather. And that's one of the big fights that we've been pushing for. I think like those are, I hope that those seem actionable.
You know, absolutely.
Meeting basic needs, developing a strategy, engaging with the people, and then creating policies that speak specifically to that conversation, right? Yeah. I think we create a lot of policy that did not take into account Skid Row, or we take policy that might work in Eagle Rock or policy that might work in Koreatown or West Adams, and then we try to put it in Skid Row and it just won't work because it doesn't take into account the realities of that community. And so I think we have to have specifically targeted policy that is informed by the people in that community.
I mean, this is a great conversation. So one of the things that Joss and I talked about is something that I hear every now and then when I hear concern for the homeless and concern for impoverished neighborhoods on the right. Mm-hmm. And I would say some of the best meaning conversation I've heard and talking points I've heard or talk about creating prosperity, like you're describing, creating business opportunities and investment and entrepreneurship. So if we can talk about that for a second, I mean, that talking point, what does that look like? And how do you start knowing when that's being used as kind of a dodge for doing nothing? What does it mean to really, what have you seen, I guess is a better question, start to move in that direction, creating some prosperity on Skid Row? Creating opportunity, that kind of thing.
I don't think you could create it for anybody. Mm-hmm. Right? I think that's the first, like, I can't create prosperity for you. I can listen to what your dreams and your aspirations are And then I can make available the resources and tools that I have to you. And if there's places where I am more informed, I can say, here is a path, here is a route, right? I think that's like the first thing. Then like tangibly, it has to be aligned with the needs communicated by the people, right? Because when we talk about prosperity, what we're really saying often is, I want to get you to the lifestyle that I have,
right?
Actually, it's actually one of those really toxic discussions when we talk about housing development, because we look at like, what is an appropriate unit size? What is an appropriate unit type? This shares a bathroom, or this, you know, all of those things. And we think of it in terms of, would I want to live here? Which is reasonable when we talk about quality, right? We don't want to make trash and then that we wouldn't live in and put people in there. But sometimes we place guidelines for people who are living in tents or are living in cardboard boxes. And so prosperity has to be defined by the people that we say that we're there to serve. And then it means taking our resources, our expertise, our dollars, and making it available to those people to build what they envision for themselves and our expertise. Because there are some times where I have to say, well, that's actually not gonna work. Like, we live in California, and if you build this type of thing, the first time that we have a minor earthquake, everything's gonna fall down, right? So this is not like abducting of reality and you know, what is ethical and what is like smart building, but it is to say, we have to get someone to their level of prosperity means allowing our resources to feed their dreams versus ours.
That's so. So that then leads me to this next question, which is, so changing policy, that's a government response and a necessary one. Changing housing law, affordable housing initiatives. What's the first thing the church can do?
I do think there's a lot of value in that discernment piece, right? I think the first thing congregations have to do is decide what they want to do, because there are two very true things. One, faith-based partners are spaces that receive and serve people that may never enter the system. And so there's this value there. When I did Faith Links, which is the project I was talking about earlier, it was based on this idea after 6 years, 7 years at that time working in homeless services, that there are some people that will never walk into a service provider, but on Sunday afternoon when they're at their last leg, they will go into a church parking lot because they saw one car in there and say, hey, my family and I need help. They will go to a soup kitchen. They will go to a clothing closet. So faith-based partners are an outlet that the city or any service program could never be. People trust faith-based communities. The second is that faith-based partners are some of the largest landholders in the world, right? And especially now, even before COVID, but particularly in COVID, unused land and unused buildings and facilities. And so there is this opportunity to make your land available to develop housing, to make your properties available for service centers, computer labs, job, you know, job placement centers. So I think those are the two things. Faith-based organizations can assess, like, what do we have to offer? What ministries are we doing that are external? And then what are our tangible resources that we have that we're not using, right? Because it's hard to get, I think some of the most fun fights to fight are getting a congregation to let their fellowship hall be used for 4 months during the winter shelter, because that means that they have to stop the programming that they would use, even if it's just like, you know, Sunday school for the little kids in the afternoon. But they're are also these buildings and properties that we're not using. Congregations have parsonages, and because parsonages are things from like when probably you and I were kids.
I'm in the parsonage right now.
Right, yeah, see, there we go. Because parsonages are no longer a thing, and congregations and are more transient now that most people don't live in the same neighborhood that their church is in, and neither do the clergy. There are these open house homes that we could be using. So I think that's the biggest thing. And then the third thing is that for our benevolent ministries, when we go and do feedings or water pass out or even prayer with people, is to connect with the institutions that are serving that community regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should stop the kind of parachute ministry, because in some ways it's disruptive. And not meaning, there are indigenous organizations that are there Monday through Sunday, you know, sun up to sundown. And we come for a day, we make folks, you know, feel good for that hour that they're there, we pass them out, we pray for them, and then we leave. Well, what if we use that same capacity to empower an agency that's there? What if we build relationships with those organizations that when we leave are still going to be there doing the same types of ministry that we are? What if we connect it to the municipal partners and stuff and said, we have 20 volunteers available once a month. How can we best be of service to this encampment? What are the things that people need? So that's actually one of the initiatives that we started this time last year, called Responsible Service, where we encourage faith-based partners and volunteer groups coming into Skid Row to connect directly with service providers in the community so that they could become more intimate with the needs of the community, and so that the ministry that they elect to do could be more sustainable and build a strong connection between that agency and our faith-based partner.
This is just, yeah, this is really, really, really helpful. We've got about 10 minutes left. I'm now wanting to ask, because I seldom get to talk to a pastor who also works in government. So let me
pray for me,
Patrick. How does the unquiet frontier between church and state live in your life as a pastor who works in the mayor's office?
Yeah, I think we have to do a better job of teaching the state how to engage congregations. I think that's probably, and Josh probably shared this with you as well, trying to figure out how to create that road to better engaging faith-based partners. And a part of that is because depending on where the congregation is on kind of the spectrum of conservative to liberal, from a well-meaning place, we want to impose our belief systems on people that come and get our services. I think there's a super nuanced conversation, because for some people that works. Like, there are some people whose lives were saved and changed because they went to a place that said, every Wednesday, if you're gonna stay here, you have to attend Bible study, right? There are some people who, the reason that they are abusing substances and the reason that they are experiencing homelessness is because they were abused by an organization or a church or a pastor or a parishioner, right? And we don't think about that trauma. And I think if we were more conscious of it, both faith partners and the city government or government, if we're willing to have that conversation, right? To say, rather than like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, to say like, no, there are some people who this worked perfectly for. There are very healthy, whole people who, if it was not for that Tuesday Bible study that for the first 3 months they were cussing and fussing to go to, they would be dead. But there are also people who are still on the street because that Tuesday Bible study was an adjutant for them and they couldn't do it. And so we have to have both. We have to be able to provide service for those who that is not, but we also have to find this avenue that makes it okay for an organization to say, these are the things that we require. And as long as they are not oppressive or exclusive because of a person's gender or gender identity or sexual expression or race or immigration status or all of the things that we figured out how to discriminate against people, then let's figure out how we do it. Because, I think one of the most powerful examples of faith-based partners in this work has been missions, who, you know, the majority of their work is they're self-funded. They have, they're open and willing to extend themselves to do the best good.
LA Mission, you mean?
I mean, yeah, LA Mission, Midnight Mission, Union Rescue Mission. I get the blessing of hanging with all the missions, right? Andy Bales has been a phenomenal presence in Skid Row. For whatever people may think about his religious beliefs, for whatever people may think about his political beliefs, I mean, they make their facility available. They make their hearts available. And I think that could be said about every group in Skid Row, that we could find a bunch of things that we don't like or that we would identify as misgivings, but all of our hearts are there. And I think sometimes we miss that when we talk about our faith communities, because there is a toxic relationship between Christians in particular and the church in particular and kind of the service system. And that's not without merit, even as a pastor. Like, I understand that there's a lot of people that are hurt because of what's happened in the church. I don't think we should lose the value of our church partners and our faith-based partners because of that. I think we got to, like, intentionally lean into what the healing experience is, you know, has to be. So I think from the government side, as a pastor, most of the barriers are about honest conversation. And that the government not try to lean on the charity expectation of the church, right? Because land is land. And if we're going to pay a developer, or a private owner of land, top price for their property, we should be willing to do the same thing for our faith-based partners. We shouldn't expect that because you're a faith-based organization, that you are going to give this parcel for free or at a discounted rate. We should not expect that just because the average education level in your congregation is a high school diploma, that we can hustle and will and deal you. I think we have to approach our faith-based partners with the same type of integrity that we would, a CEO of a major nonprofit, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And so finality, I think it is a relationship that we have to intentionally approach.
So what it sounds to me like is that the foundation of good public service in Skid Row, the foundation of good like church mission in Skid Row, and the foundation of building these partnerships between the outreach of the state and the outreach of the church is about showing up and being ready to build relationships,
yeah,
and being community with each other for the long term. That's something that we can start doing today.
I think for faith-based partners, what's important is like to learn to navigate your municipal partners. That's the hardest part. Everybody wants, like, we want to meet with the mayor. And honestly, like, that's the worst place to start, because
where's the best place to start?
Like with your local representative, right? So when I was a field rep, one of the best things was to be able to go out and see what a congregation was doing in terms of their ministries and homeless ministries or whatever it was, because then I could take that information into the office. And it doesn't start with like, oh, we need $1 million. It really is like build the relationship, and then if you're having something, get a person, whether it's the principal or if it is like a person who's in a department. You know, if you have an arts program, the mayor might not be the first person you want. You might want the director from cultural affairs, but learning how to navigate, because You could spend a year trying to get the mayor to come to your banquet to present a certificate and never get him. But in 3 months, you could have your local, like your most local person, invite somebody who's like a middle manager, and they'd be so impressed that, you know, a month after that, they're like, we got to get the mayor here. So it just, I think somebody should teach a class that educates faith-based partners how to engage municipal leadership. Because there's like all these different routes. I know congregations that have never, the mayor's never been there. Never, ever, ever, ever been to their church, but they're getting like a bunch of resources and they're getting a bunch of stuff done, and they've got some really stable partnerships inside the city. So like, you know, our mayor is a nice guy, and he's like really charismatic and has a great heart and really cares about the people. But I could think about five people who you would rather have engaging before him, because they're going to be able to get you to what you need.
All right. So here's my final question to you. All right. You are someone engaged in ministry, engaged in service. You'd pour your soul out to make the lives of people who are hurting just a little bit better. Mm. Now my question to you is, what feeds your soul? What pours into your soul? Do you go home and you listen to vinyl records? Do you read books? Do you go to cool vacation spots? What do you do?
Oh, man. I guess I got to give like the real answer. I won't give you the pastor answer.
Yeah, come on.
So I am, I love live music. And so live music, but my thing, and particularly over COVID, I do is I infuse cigars. So I'm a big cigar enthusiast, and I like whiskey.
Ooh, come. All right. Hold up. You know, have you been to Bark? I shouldn't say this as the pastor on the podcast. I'm going to say anyway.
Yeah. Well,
have you been? Okay. We'll wrap before this. Have you been to Barkeeper over in Silver Lake? Do you know this spot? All right, so I'm gonna bequeath this to you, right? Because okay. As Emmanuel loves whiskey, so Barkeeper, right, is this specialty liquor vendor, and he's in Silver Lake, and it's a hipster liquor spot, but he's real good. His name is Wesley.
Okay.
If you walk in there and say you're a whiskey drinker, he'll give you three things to look at. He'll describe each one of them, and it'll blow your mind. He's real good.
I'll check it out. Yeah.
So you use cigars. So what do you, where do you get your tobacco? Do you grow your own tobacco or what?
No. So there is, I guess it's a shameless plug. There's a cigar lounge, Debonair Cigar Lounge, over in like the mid-city area, and they have their own blend. So I go buy a bunch of those. I pick the whiskeys that I really like. And then I do the infusion process, who one of the owners taught me. And so over COVID, when I couldn't go anywhere, that was like my hobby. But yeah, live music. My wife and I do have a record player, and we're big like Fela Kuti fans, Gil Scott Heron, Kamasi Washington. And then hip hop. And then I guess the other thing is I run. So I run. Okay. Yeah, I run about 27 miles a week, and Fridays I'll run on the beach. Mondays and Wednesdays, I'll run just out in the city. And if anytime I travel or go anywhere, even overseas, I go running. That's like my therapy. So part of the reason I'm able to stay sane is also the reason my legs are sore, right?
Yeah. Are you the kind of person, like, do you like to have just no sound but the sound of your feet and the sound of the air?
Oh, no, I have a playlist. Mondays are gospel, Tuesdays are old school hip hop or hip hop, and then Fridays can be anything between like reggae, Afrobeat. It kind of depends. Sometimes I'll just pick some artist I never heard of.
Did you ever read or listen to Haruki Murakami's little memoir, What I Talk About When I Talk About Running?
No, I need to now. Yeah, send me that too.
He's this Japanese surrealist author, and but he's been writing for like 20 years. He started running when he turned 30. Started writing when he turned 30. So his running career and his writing career started at the same time.
Oh wow, yeah, that's like me, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's just a little memoir. I mean, it's like over 100 pages, just about his running and writing career and what that's like. But it's a great audiobook if you decide to break with your music for a bit.
Send me that. I'll definitely take a listen. I got to hop on another call.
Yeah.
I pray this gave you what you needed. Thanks.
It really did.
Talk about the blessing of being able to work in such an awesome community. And let's continue to stay connected, brother.
That was the Reverend Kirkpatrick Tyler, African Methodist Episcopal preacher and director of Skid Row Outreach from Mayor Garcetti's office. And I'm Pastor Kurt Poland. Thanks for listening to the Broken Middle podcast and taking a step out into the open with us today. We'll see you next time.